Welcome to a podcast called Intrepid. My name is Craig Forces. I'm here with Stephanie Carvin in the observation room at the University of Ottawa's courtroom. Stephanie, what do we have on the agenda today?
Well, today we are lucky to have Jess Davis on the podcast. She is a national security consultant and the president of Insight Threat Intelligence. And she's also a former national security analyst. And I should say for our audience, we did have the fabulous opportunity to work together. So if you hear some laughing, that might be why. And of course, you are a former national security analyst with, I believe, both FINTRAC and the Canadian Security Intelligence Service.
That's right.
Okay. Well, let's talk about some threat finance.
Sounds great.
Can I start by asking what do we mean by threat finance? Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily an intuitive term, or it may come with certain baggage. People may make assumptions about what it is. What is it?
Well, it really depends on what perspective you're talking from. So when I used to work at CSIS, threat financing was really something that was defined as part of our act. So if it was a threat to the security of Canada, there was a financial component. So that means that there was a financial component to espionage or sabotage, foreign influence activity, terrorism, those kinds of things. It's really about how threat actors finance their activities. And I think one of the things that's not as intuitive is that people don't tend to think about how, you know, spies get their money or how other threats will really manifest from a financial perspective. But you have to pay your spies, you have to pay for their cover, you have to buy strategic assets, you have to pay for your terrorist attack, procure your illicit materials and goods, that kind of thing. So the threat financing piece is really a CSIS specific piece of it, and so it's defined in the threats are defined in the Act. Now what I do is I really look more from an illicit financing perspective, so if it's a bit of a broader umbrella from which to look at those illicit actors.
You talked about the CSIS perspective. Is there other perspectives from looking at it as well?
Well, some people would define threat financing as including things like international organized crime.
Right.
So a bit of a broader remit, and there's certainly overlap in all of these different areas. You know, it is helpful from a national security perspective to put a bit of a firmer boundary around that. Otherwise,
right,
you're straying into a whole bunch of different things.
Right, like drug smuggling and
yeah,
human smuggling, things like that.
Yeah, and all of those things can contribute to different aspects of threat finance. And certainly terrorist organizations use that as a way to raise money for their activities. But yeah, sometimes
it has to be anchored to one of the threats.
At CSIS, yeah. And now we can just talk about whatever we want. So.
Right.
So it sounds like the phenomena that it can cross-cut different possible illicit activity. I remember discussions about diamonds from West Africa and financing, at least early financing of Al-Qaeda, some discussions of that back decades ago. And so it seems it could involve all sorts of different actors, some of whom pose a national security risk, some of whom pose a public order risk or a criminal risk. Is that true? Are the instruments commingled according to these different potential sources of peril, or are there discrete tools or instruments that are associated with national security threats that are disaggregated from the other sorts of dangers?
I would say that it's really commingling of all of these different types of ways to finance their activities. So, you know, a really sophisticated terrorist organization, for example, will use as many different methods of financing its activity as possible, including some completely legitimate or legal business ventures. Of course, once you start diverting those funds away from a legitimate business into a terrorist group, that is no longer legal. But, you know, you'll see them using all these different methods to raise, move money, and the more diverse it is, the more of a challenge it is.
Right. Because one of the issues that came out after 9/11, and certainly more recently with other forms of terrorism, focusing specifically on terrorism, is that these things aren't necessarily that expensive. And so the issue may well be is, first of all, if it's not that expensive, there's not that much money, so how difficult does it become to track it? Secondly, is the emphasis on terrorism financing enough to deter or stave off these perils?
Well, you've raised two really good and difficult questions to really unpack in a short period of time. I think people need to really understand that while terrorism can be cheap, there's two really different things here. There's organizational financing of a terrorist organization, and that's not cheap. Generally speaking, terrorist organizations need a huge amount of money to survive. ISIS is a great example. We're talking millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars to sort of fund their activities and operations
right
on the ground in Syria and Iraq. Same thing with Al-Qaeda.
Because they have a governmental presence.
Yeah, exactly. And most terrorist organizations that are really sort of quite active will burn through money at a pretty high rate. What's not expensive is individual cells and individual attackers, so that operational financing. So I try to make the distinction between organizational and operational financing. Then when you look at the international framework for countering terrorist financing, it's really geared primarily to that organizational piece of it. And same thing even at the national level in Canada, we've got good rules and regulations and guidelines around detecting and deterring terrorist financing, but really they're at the organizational level, less so at the operational level. And we can get into that.
Well, actually, this might be a good chance to then to talk about what a regime actually looks like.
Yeah. So you mentioned that we've got good laws, and I'm inclined to agree with you. I think certainly since 2001, we've built up the laws in areas of terrorism financing specifically, mm-hmm. to a great extent. It's a bit complex, though, right? Because the way that this system evolved, it evolved in fits and starts. And so at 9/11, we weren't actually party to the 1999 Terrorism Financing Convention, the International Treaty on Terrorism Financing. And yet, right after 9/11, we were instructed by the Security Council and Security Council Resolution 1373 to not just criminalize terrorism, but also to address terrorism financing. We didn't have a law in the books. And so what we did is we introduced regulations under the UN Act, which is our instrument that allows us to enforce UN resolutions and sanctions. And we introduced two regulations, actually. One that was dealt with Al-Qaeda and Taliban, and another that allowed what I'll call unilateral listing. And so Al-Qaeda and Taliban, persons who were listed by the UN itself as being affiliated with Al-Qaeda and Taliban, financial dealings with them was suddenly illegal. A separate regime allowed the Governor and Council, the Federal Cabinet, to list other entities and persons, and dealings with them would also be illicit. And then a few months later, in Bill C-36, 2001, we introduced this new criminal code, terrorism listing regime. All three regimes actually exist at present.
Right.
And so we have now in the criminal code listed entities, and any kind of financial dealing with those listed entities is illicit and is a crime. There's actually also prospects of property seizure under the criminal code. And so there's actually an administrative process where you can seize property from a terrorist group. And as best I know, it's never been used, and it's an administrative proceeding. It doesn't actually require a conviction, nor does it actually require the property to have been used for terrorist purposes. It's the possibility that it could be used for terrorist purposes.
The seizure of the Iranian properties, they weren't done under that act.
And not as best I know, because those issues related to the lawsuits, I believe, that were permitted under the amendments.
Justice for Victims of Terrorism Act?
Yeah.
Right, okay.
So as best I know, this wasn't done under the criminal code provisions.
Okay.
But what we have at present now is we've got a regime for penalizing financial relations with listed members of Al-Qaeda and Taliban under the UN Act. We've got a separate regime under the UN Act for certain unilaterally listed, that is, listed by the government, entities and persons that include things like various Northern Ireland-related terrorist groups.
The Provisional IRA?
Yeah, so I have the list here. It includes the Ulster Defence Association and the Continuity Irish Republican Army. And
right,
so,
okay.
So there are these listed entities under the regulation. And then we've got a third tranche of listed entities, no individuals, but entities under the criminal code for whom any kind of financial dealing is criminal as well. So it's a very complicated regime.
And then you've got the Proceeds of Crime, Money Laundering, Terrorist Financing Act, which really implements sort of the monitoring of financial transactions
right.
in Canada. And that, I would also echo that sort of piecemeal approach. So that was originally money laundering legislation. They tacked on the terrorist financing piece. And over the course of the last, I'd say probably 10 to 12 years, they've slowly amended small sections of that to include more of the threat element as well, to allow FinTrack to disclose information related to the threats to the security of Canada to appropriate disclosure recipients. So it is a bit of a, there's been an evolution in the regime, but it is a complex regime that deals with a lot of different pieces of legislation.
Yeah, and what's, of course, disappointing about the regime is that it looks good on the books, but we don't have much evidence that it's had much of an impact, at least in the public domain. Why? Because we've had very few prosecutions, either prosecutions fueled by information from FinTrack or other forms of prosecutions that relate to the terrorism financing provisions. And so we've had one terrorism prosecution, plain and simple, there was no other charge, involving the Tamil Tigers. And that actually went to the BC Court of Appeal. It's now about 10 years old, I believe, 6-month sentence. There are a couple of other cases where there are a whole host of charges. And so Khawaja, for example, the first terrorism case, it involved a whole host of charges, one of which was terrorism financing. But, of course, that case turned on a whole bunch of activity above and beyond terrorism financing. And so we have these laws in the books that look quite good. We have a history in Canada of Canada being a significant source, as I understand it, I mean, this is a good question for you, of terrorism financing, going back to some of the issues around the Tamil Tigers and others, where Canada, there was issues around fundraising by terrorist groups for conflicts in foreign jurisdictions. We have this long history. In fact, in 2003, I believe, Human Rights Watch put out a report about essentially extortion of the Tamil community in Toronto for fundraising purposes by the Tamil Tigers. And so we have this history, and of course we have all these recent reports about financing issues, and yet we have very few prosecutions. And I don't know what the issue is. I don't know whether this is just not a sufficient allocation of resources for purposes of policing in this area, or whether these cases are just hard and we go after the low-hanging fruit and not the hard financing cases. But maybe this is a question for you, Jess.
Well, you know, when Steph originally sort of asked me about this, her way of phrasing it was, why are we so bad at this?
Yeah, no, really, why are we so bad at this?
And I think it's important to keep in mind that bad is really relative. So if we're comparing ourselves to the United States, they get a lot of material support charges, a lot of which deal with financing specifically, and a lot of those are standalone charges. Craig can go into some of the more details about whether or not that would really stand in Canadian court, but, you know, from my perspective, from more of an intelligence analyst perspective, if you have terrorist financing, you have probably a host of other terrorist activity. So in Canada, it would be very strange, from my perspective, to see a straight standalone terrorist financing charge, because you're probably going to be seeing a lot of other things. And to go back to your question, Craig, about what we've got in terms of financing activity happening here in Canada, well, I think that we don't see as much as there actually is. We're not a major financial hub in the world like Hong Kong, like London, like New York, like Dubai. So we don't have to be quite as good at catching terrorist financing, money laundering, or threat financing as they have to be. So there's less international pressure on us. But at the same time, we have a good, open, secure financial system in Canada, and the history has proven that people will exploit that. Now, in terms of why we're not that good at it, aside from the actual prosecution question, which I think is really beyond my area of expertise, and I have a lot of questions about that too, so unfortunately you're not going to get any answers around that. Having not worked in law enforcement, it's not really my piece. But there is a question about the regime. So from my perspective, the regime doesn't address some of the real financing questions. And this is actually a broad international problem. So there's a real lack of up-to-date, open-source information on all aspects of threat financing that policymakers could use to update laws, regulations, guidelines, all those kinds of things. Instead, they're doing it based on probably some classified information, if that's available to them, some piecemeal open-source information, and then what other people decide are the risks to the regime. And I'm not entirely sure that those updates really reflect the reality of what's going on the ground in terms of terrorist financing. And we talked already a little bit about that difference between the organizational financing piece and the operational financing piece. And Mobin Kawaj is a great example of this. So I did want to bring it up because I think it highlights some of the discrepancies between that operational piece and FinTrack's actual regulations. So he was involved in a variety of terrorist financing activities. He provided between 800 to 1,000 pounds and a quantity of Canadian currency to one of UK plotters that he was involved with. He also had a female friend of his open a bank account on his behalf, give him the debit card associated with it. So it wasn't in his name. So this is actually pretty sophisticated tradecraft from a terrorist financing perspective. He also had her wire over $5,000 using Western Union to those UK plotters. And he also provided another £2,000 to the London cell. So I'm telling you all these numbers because the actual reporting threshold for FinTrack is $10,000 or more to report an international electronic funds transfer or a suspicious transaction. So in order for these transactions to have been reported to FinTrack, they would have had to been deemed suspicious by the reporting entity, or they would have hit that threshold. Now, I don't know very many terrorists who send $10,000 at a time internationally. So there's that piece of it, and that's just one example of how the regime isn't maybe keeping pace with some of the realities of operational financing. I would also say that new technologies, including financial technologies, are a huge challenge because financial technologies are emerging so quickly that how do you adjust an entire legal framework that's only reviewed every 5 years to, you know, a fintech company who started an entirely new payment platform out of Toronto and they've been up and running for a year? This, the responsiveness of the regime is one of the things that really needs to change because terrorists don't take 5 years to adopt those technologies. They adopt them right away, and then we have to react. But by then, the horse is out of the barn.
Right. So Bitcoin, that sort of stuff.
Exactly. Right. But even
they would have lost a lot of money in Bitcoin, though.
Yeah, depending. I still remember when the Bitcoin price really, really dropped, and I was kind of like, yes. Just in case anybody had been investing in it that was a threat actor. The other thing that I think you might find interesting, and it's more from an intelligence analyst perspective, so Steph, I think maybe you will have some things to say about this one, is that I'm not sure that the Canadian Security and Intelligence Agencies really understand the skill set that's required to be a good threat finance analyst. I think people really think that you need to be a forensic accountant. And forensic accountants have their place. They're really great for going through complex documents. But that's really quite a rare phenomenon in Canada. Like, you're not going to get sort of the entire business records of a terrorist organization. You're going to get piecemeal information. And that information is going to come to you from all different kinds of sources. So it's going to come through SIGINT. It's going to come through HUMINT. It's going to come through dedicated financial intelligence collection platforms like FinTrack or through banking records, most of which are not actually that complex, but you have to be an excellent critical thinker. You have to understand the sources, caveats, how to really evaluate that intelligence. So you really need to be a much better all-source intelligence analyst than necessarily a forensic accountant. And I think that there has been an inclination to hire some of those more technical people, whereas you really need that more well-rounded intelligence analyst perspective. And the other thing that's really...
Or at least marrying the two together.
Yeah. You certainly have to have a facility with financial information, and you have to have some comfort with financial information. The other thing that's really important about this is that I think that there's been a bit of a lack of imagination in how to get a really good threat finance analyst. And this is actually something I kind of learned from the military is... When I was in the military and I was doing some work with the intelligence branch, it was really about preparation of the battle space, so like terrain analysis. And what I'm really saying here is that to understand how a terrorist organization or any sort of threat actor is going to finance its activity, you have to understand the geography they're operating in, the economic situation they're operating in, the culture they're operating in, and then to go down to a bit more of a micro level, what their group norms are, what the ideology of the group or the threat actor is, and only then will you really understand how they're going to finance their activities. So it's really more of an economic anthropological approach than an accounting approach.
That's fascinating in terms of thinking about it, because like you said, I think most people think it's going to be some kind of accountors or forensic accountants. Maybe that's from Hollywood or the TV shows, but it is interesting. I guess it might be worth just running through some of the organizations in Canada that have this responsibility, because one of the things I was thinking of with the why are we so bad at this is that there's no dedicated body, really, I believe, in Canada that just looks at threat financing. There's various units and various different departments. And, you know, there's a question here, I think, of information sharing and been following up with prosecution. So you have FinTrack, which you have some experience with, Jess.
And they have a pretty broad remit in terms of analyzing information. So they have a remit to analyze money laundering, to analyze and disclose information related to money laundering, terrorist financing, and on the disclosure side, threats to the security of Canada. They also have a strategic component that can produce those sort of reports.
Right.
And is there some issue with FinTrack, though, about the degree of cooperation from the financial sector and the banks, for instance? So if you juxtapose the compliance record on the U.S. side, it seems to me that on the U.S. side, their equivalent has been much more aggressive and compelling participation in the disclosure regime by their banks than has been true in Canada. At least that's my impression from some of the reading I've been doing.
I would say I don't have any sort of first-hand knowledge of there being an issue between FinTrack and the banks. In fact, I think that most of the banks and most reporting entities in Canada have every incentive and are keen to cooperate with FinTrack. I think there has been some pushback on perhaps having the $10,000 threshold lowered and seeing whether or not that would be a burden on some of those financial institutions. I think that might be the pushback that you're sort of thinking of.
So, I mean, that's interesting that you say that with the relationship with the banks. I mean, there has been some recent reporting, I believe in the Toronto Star, about some challenges that some banks weren't reporting everything that they perhaps should have, and then the bank wasn't named, but I think it was eventually found out that it was Manulife.
Yeah, so what actually happened in that instance, and I was an outsider at the time, I was not working at FinTrack at the time, is that the bank in question, and I think you're right, it was Manulife, that was they were found to be non-compliant with their reporting requirements,
right?
And they were issued an administrative monetary penalty. Now, traditionally, those administrative monetary penalties, or AMPs, as they're called in the lingo,
right,
are named. So you can go onto FinTrack's website and you can see all of the different entities that have received an administrative monetary penalty. But it was quite controversial that FinTrack did not name this bank. And I can't remember exactly what the reasons for it were, potentially reputational, but it was a very interesting decision by the director of FinTrack at the time to not name that bank.
Yeah, I mean, so I guess that this is where some of the concerns are, have been with FinTrack. They haven't been able to, like, really hand out these AMPs, as you've called them, in the same way that's been done in the United States. So this has been some of the criticisms that, A, that, you know, maybe they aren't naming things that they should be, and B, we just seem to be doing less of it. I'm not saying that you have all the answers to that, but some of the questions. So FinTrack's one, does Bank of Canada have any responsibilities here?
Not only in ensuring the stability of the Canadian financial sector. So
right,
it's pretty far removed from the actual PCML TFA framework.
Right. Okay. And then, of course, CSIS, we've already talked about that they investigate in relationship to their mandate.
That's right.
In number Article 2 of the CSIS Act, and then or Section 2. And then finally, the RCMP, which would be in charge of prosecution for these behaviors.
Exactly. And then you also have Canada Border Services Agency.
Right.
Provincial and regional police forces who are recipients of disclosure information from FinTrack. Communication Security Establishment.
Right. So there's a number of organizations here.
I might have forgotten one or two because there's quite a number of people who are involved in the regime. Yeah.
But I guess, I mean, what I'm trying to say here is, like, it just seems like there's a number of actors that seem to have their finger in the pie, as it were. I always go back to pie, because that's how I roll on this podcast. But like, finger in the pie of kind of terrorism finance. But there's questions of, like, maybe how well all the big picture works together, and whether or not that explains some of the challenges or that we've seen raised either in the media or the fact that we've only really had one terrorism financing prosecution.
I think you raise a bit of an interesting point there, because, you know, FinTrack is not an investigative agency. They're an administrative unit in Canada. So they're not going to ever take the lead, per se, on an investigation. So it's really up to CSIS and the RCMP and the regional law and provincial law enforcement to drive those investigations. So if any of that, if we're finding that there are deficiencies in terms of actual outcomes for the regime, those deficiencies lie with those investigative agencies. And so FinTrack will disclose all kinds of information. And actually, if you go to their annual report, you can see exactly how much they've disclosed to the RCMP and to CSIS on investigations that are information that would be relevant to a terrorist financing investigation. And that's kind of an important piece of that language. And so you can see how much they're disclosing on those to those investigative bodies and agencies. And I say that the relevant to a terrorist financing investigation is important, because when you look at the FinTrack annual report, it's important to remember that those disclosures do not mean that those were cases of terrorist financing. They were cases that involved some sort of movement of money that could be relevant to that type of investigation.
Right.
So it could be providing background or context or even social networks for people, depending on what that looks like. But it may not actually be terrorist financing that's being disclosed in those instances.
Right. And we've had some recent reporting out of British Columbia about the movement of information suggesting that, in this case, it was a laundering of money through casinos. And then the follow-up by law enforcement, by the RCMP, in terms of investigating in some fairly harsh words, as I recall some of the reporting coming out of former members of the RCMP, not least. So is this a systemic issue with our ability to grapple with financial crime generally, that we just don't have the resources that are deployed, or at least the proper resources deployed?
You know, from my time in the security and intelligence world, I would say that those resources exist. And there are some very, very highly skilled investigators and people who can do that kind of work. Where I really think we fall down is a lack of interest, both at sort of the senior bureaucratic level, but also at the political level in terms of pursuing those kinds of cases. It took a long time for some of the work that I've done to really gain traction in the community, and only when I was able to really demonstrate some tangible outcomes was that the case. But I would also say that even within some of our investigative agencies, finding people who are willing to dedicate the time and resources that it takes to become experts in this is really hard, because it's not the sexiest thing in the world. This isn't the kind of thing that's going to get you all the promotions.
Oh, come on.
I mean, I think it's fantastic.
So cool, yeah.
I could talk about money all day long, but, you know, people do have a bit of reticence to talk about it, to investigate it, and the amount of time that it requires to really get into it. And then there's a lot of dead ends. Like, I think one of the things that I found working with people in this field is that the number of dead ends that you have to run down before you actually get a lead can be really daunting. And there's a lot of time in the chair that gets spent that way. So, but it's just like, it's not all that different from looking at somebody's social network. You'll look at 75 people who will be really boring, and then three of them will be co-conspirators in a threat activity, whatever. And it's the same thing with money. You know, you'll look at 15 people who this individual sent money to, and you're like, well, that was great. It was his grandma, it was his sister, it was his daughter. Who's that?
So
and it takes time to get there.
Yeah. So I guess, like, I mean, this kind of brings me back to a question I really want to ask, which is, maybe less on the prosecution side, but what really is the value of financial intelligence? And what can that really, how does that inform an investigation?
I think it might be worthwhile to quickly just define what financial intelligence is.
Yes, please.
For your listeners, because I think there's a lot of misconceptions around that as well. So financial intelligence, we use the term finint. I think you might have already used
finint,
it once.
Yeah.
Finint's quite fun. Is intelligence is of a financial nature, but it can be collected from a variety of methods. I already mentioned through HUMAN, through SIGINT, and through those dedicated financial intelligence collection platforms that we mentioned. But it doesn't have to include that transaction level data. It's that contextual information, though, that really can provide the understanding of what the threat activity is. So financial intelligence can tell us about people's intent and capability and threat actors' intent and capability. So a couple of examples, you know, unexplained sources of money in people's accounts can lend credibility to questions about whether or not they're engaged in espionage activity,
right,
for instance.
Right.
But, you know, we can look at the Investment Canada Act as well and say, you know, tracing the actual financing of an asset purchase, if it's in Canada and that's triggered Investment Canada Act review, can tell us who the ultimate beneficiary of that is, if you can get through all of those sort of corporate layers and different companies. It can also tell us about the seriousness of someone's intentions. And a really good example of this is from a young woman in Montreal, so we're going back a few years now, who traveled to join the Islamic State. Her parents were interviewed as part of an academic study that was being done, and this actually reflects some of CSIS's work on indicators of mobilization of violence. So her parents actually told the academics who were doing the study that, you know, her behavior did change in advance, and they knew that she was serious because she stopped paying for small items such as coffee and was using that money to sort of save for her plane ticket. And the thing is, and this is what I've learned over the course of my time doing this kind of work, is that people don't change their financial behavior unless they're serious. And we can all reflect on our own personal life circumstances, and I think it can really bolster that claim, but we don't see people changing their behavior around money until they're ready to actually take action on their beliefs.
So it's a flag. Financial
it's a
intelligence
huge
can be a flag.
Right? It's a huge, and it's well beyond a flag. I would say it moves right into the realm of indicator properly.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, CSIS and its Indicators of Mobilization to Violence report that came out this year basically said that financial indicators are actually one of the first signs of mobilization to violence. So, yeah, it would be consistent with that finding.
Now, you mentioned the Islamic State near the beginning of our conversation as being in a slightly different realm, perhaps, than some other terrorist groups, in part because they operate on a territory of their own, or at least they did, ran a quasi-governmental establishment, had revenues from oil and the like. There's been some recent reporting about companies that continue to do business. So for those who have been following the Globe and Mail reporting on Lafarge, the big cement company, continue to do business in the area controlled by ISIS, by Daesh. Can you describe some of the financial complexities associated with that rather unique terrorist entity and the sort of knock-ons that we see now with some issues around corporate culpability,
mm-hmm,
or potentially culpability?
You're referring to the Globe and Mail story,
yes,
about
the cement company Lafarge.
Yes, and the Canadian that is caught up in that.
Yes.
And some of the complexities around ISIS's financing,
right,
as well.
Right, exactly, yeah.
So,
because they're a resource-based entity and they have a taxation system, or did have a taxation system. So how much of it is externally financed, and there's a market aspect if they're selling their oil?
Yeah, so ISIS is such an interesting phenomenon. But it's actually not unique in the history of terrorist organizations. Right. Basically, any terrorist organization that's able to control territory of any type will use a taxation base, extortion, the extraction of resources within their territory to raise funds. So Al-Shabaab's done it. Al-Qaeda's done it when they control territory.
The Armed
territory.
Revolutionary Forces of Colombia, FARC.
Yeah, there was a very interesting resource that they could extract there.
Right.
So every terrorist group that can do it will do it. What I think was surprising about ISIS, and it wasn't really surprising, it was more just shocking, was the scope of money, the scale of money that they were able to raise based on some of those, the resources that were in that territory. So they took over relatively wealthy, oil-rich area and then reaped the windfalls from that. In terms of how much they're getting from each thing, this is like probably the question of the century. Nobody really knows how much they got, and it's, you know, you have to do it over time, so you have to look at, okay, well, in this month, in this location, you have to get into the really nitty-gritty details and then do that for every way that they're raising money. We know that the group probably got the bulk of their money from activities in Syria. However, increasingly, we're starting to see reporting coming out and prosecutions about people sending money to the Islamic State. And the thing that's really interesting about this is that it's not that the group needed the money from people. They wanted people to demonstrate their commitment to the cause by sending that money. Again, demonstrating the seriousness of their intent. And this is also one of the ways that people were demonstrating to themselves and to other people the seriousness of their intent. So maybe they didn't have it in them to conduct a terrorist attack in the United States or in Canada or in the UK, but they did have it in them to cross that legal threshold and provide funds to a terrorist organization. And for me, that's a threshold step. As soon as you're able to cross that threshold, then you're really demonstrating that you're all in.
Right. I guess the other, I was going to say, the other really kind of weird thing for the Islamic State was they actually tried to invent their own currency. I don't know how serious they were about it, but like it was just kind
this was my favorite thing. I still remember the day that I read about this and I thought to myself, excellent. I wish them all the best managing both fiscal and monetary policies.
But it's kind of weird, but it just goes to show you like the kind of the central role of money in ISIS as a financial organization.
Oh, absolutely.
That they tried to do that as well.
But your discussion raises again for me the issue of prosecutions. And so the terrorism financing...
A lawyer concerned about prosecutions?
Well,
I'm shocked.
But terrorism financing is actually a lot, in many respects, if you read the provisions in the criminal code, it's a lot easier to cross that line than it might be for some other terrorism crimes. So here's $5. Right. And so if you have people who are sending money as a demonstration of fidelity, then it's almost the Al Capone thing. Okay, well, I can't get them for participation or facilitation or terrorism travel, but I can get them for terrorism financing. And you would assume that the information that would support the prosecution would be easier to come by because the financial records are more readily accessible. The issue, I suppose, is that they may be doing so in covert manners that are difficult to track without intelligence. But nevertheless, the fact that we haven't seen any prosecutions... self-standing prosecutions, at least, outside of this one involving the Tamil Tigers for terrorism financing. I know that you don't
are
have
you,
the answer.
You're not trying to get a roundabout way of suggesting there's a financial intelligence evidence
problem. Oh my gosh, I was going to say it.
Drink. All right.
Yeah. and this is exactly what I was thinking as Craig was talking, is that even in the intelligence world, I would rarely say something like, so-and-so provided funds to the Islamic State. That is a point-blank statement that's very difficult to draw conclusively.
Right.
I would say something like, Stephanie Carvin is believed to have given money to an ISIS financial facilitator.
Ma'am.
But then you've got to prove ISIS financial facilitator. So we can prove that Stephanie sent money to that financial facilitator. Now you've got to prove that this financial facilitator, who could actually be a third party and is actually not in any way associated with ISIS, then provided that money to the Islamic State. So then you're starting to get really deeply into the intelligence space. So while we can do that very simple, basic Stephanie Carvin to financial facilitator hop, and that probably is going to be reported to FinTrack, and we can get that into the evidence space, it's the next end of it that can become very complicated.
So here's what I wonder.
And of course, it depends on what time the time space as well, right? Because people's roles change over time.
Right.
So if Steph sent it in 2013.
That's different potentially than if it was later.
And you got to really watch the time frames.
So the podcast, the New York Times podcast, Caliphate, the last few episodes were going through these records because I guess another aspect that maybe distinguishes Daesh from other terrorist groups is they had really good records. And a lot of them are now being recovered, or at least some of them are being recovered. And so if
if one was sending money, if Steph was sending money to show fidelity to
Daesh,
why am
I always the bad guy?
That might be recorded on their end, even if it's difficult to trace on our end. And so there's the prospect then of reverse engineering the financial contribution.
The prospect exists, although I would also caution that, again, they're probably using intermediaries, third parties, financial facilitators as a central point.
Yeah.
And so there's probably very little actual contact between a core ISIS member and Stephanie.
Right.
I'm going to try to say this as many times as possible. which isn't actually very fair, because I think we all know that if Stephanie was providing some sort of support to a terrorist organization,
it would be baked good,
some material support, which isn't a charge in Canada.
Holy poop cupcakes for ISIS.
And I suppose the other issue is if you get some hard drive from some bombed out place in Syria and it's got some financial records, you can imagine what a defense lawyer would do with that in terms of its credibility.
But even from an intelligence perspective, I'd say the same thing. Okay, where were we found? Where did we find it? Who do we think it belonged to? Do we have any... can we corroborate that in any kind of way? And then again, you're like, well, it looks like she sent money to this person. But there's a lot of space. There's a lot of space for uncertainty there.
Right.
So I guess, I mean, is there anything else that you think our listeners should know about financial intelligence and tracking kind of threat finance?
Yeah, there is one other thing that I think people really need to know. So when you were going through the regime and talking about all the different regime partners, we missed one really important regime partner.
Okay.
And that's the private sector.
Ah.
So the private sector reporting entities that are defined under the PCML TFA, so you can go look them up if you want to know exactly who they are. So banks, financial institutions, credit unions, money services, businesses, and the list is extensive, so I won't go into the whole thing, are a critical partner in this. But the thing about, and I'll use banks generally, but we're talking about all reporting entities, is that they are good at implementing their regulations. A couple of cases notwithstanding, you know, the ones who get the administrative monetary penalties. And from my experience working with them in different capacities, they have a lot of willingness to implement those regulations. But they also suffer from a serious lack of open source information. And they're struggling with two different kinds of risk. They're struggling with the risk of not enforcing the regulations properly, but they're also struggling with reputational risk. So it's not simply enough to say all of your regulations are in place if your bank is found to be providing financial services to a terrorist or somebody who ends up going and committing a terrorist attack. So they need information that allows them to proactively implement new rules and policies within their own institutions in order to effectively counter terrorist financing. But they need the information to do that. They can't just make it up. And the regulations are never going to adapt to terrorist financing, the practicalities of terrorist financing, in the same kind of way that banks can adapt. They can be much quicker about it than the 5-year legislative review will be. And so they're the ones who really are a critical piece in this puzzle, but you know, without that information, it's very difficult for them to do their jobs. They also have a bit of a tendency to de-risk or de-bank people very, very quickly. So you can have an ongoing investigation, and they can, you know, if you share that name, they can be excluded from the financial sector.
So much for
sector.
Your covert investigation.
Yeah, and there are, and certainly I would imagine that there are partnerships involved and stuff, but they are a risk-averse organizations, and therefore like a really critical piece of the regime.
So the last thing I want to talk about really is kind of you a little bit, because we've kind of hinted at it throughout this podcast. You've had this really amazing career kind of in the national security space. You've been in the military. You worked at FinTract. You work at CSIS. You're also the author of Women in Modern Terrorism. And you're working on a new book on terrorism finance. So I just kind of want to unpack this a little bit. Do you have any advice? I mean, often, like, I like to talk about, like, women in national security, but also just for anyone who's contemplating a career, I think you've already given some really good advice, at least in terms of those who might be interested in thinking about threat finance as a career. But is there anything else that you would want people to know?
Combating threat finance.
Or, yes, not actually doing it. No.
Although I think that the first one is much more lucrative.
I'm going to get, like, facilitation charges. I'm already associated with ISIS now.
Advice is a bit of a tough one. I can only really reflect on my own experience and sort of think about the things that went really, really poorly and the things that went well. In terms of what I think I got pretty lucky on is that I had a variety of different jobs. So as you hinted at, I was in the military for a few years. I got a job at Foreign Affairs for a little bit, FinTrack and CSIS. And really, there was no there was no master plan there. It was just me following things that looked interesting. And so what I would say is that the idea of a master plan or trying to sort of get these different jobs is a bit, I mean, you can try to do that, but I think it's just going to create a lot of stress. Whereas I think you should just take really interesting jobs as they come up and sort of see where that leads you. And it'll probably lead you to just quitting the government at some point in time and starting your company.
Right. And what is your company focusing on now?
Yeah, so we do a number of different things. So
yeah, I think you're our first, I should say, I think you're our first kind of private sector person. Yeah. So
Basically, I focus on providing consulting services along four main areas of expertise. So certainly on the illicit financing piece, providing advice to reporting entities, but also to foreign and domestic financial intelligence units about what the current threat looks like. So trying to provide that open source piece so that people can be a lot more, can react in a much more educated manner to the current threats and really manage that reputational risk as well as the regulatory one. I do some training and some speaking on indicators of terrorist activity. Definitely I do some education around women in terrorism because I think there's still a lot of misconceptions about women's roles in terrorism. Most people will say that women aren't involved in terrorism, but we now know that actually 25% of most terrorist organizations are generally women, and they do play a variety of roles. And so there's some ongoing questions about whether or not security services and law enforcement, not just in this country, are fully investigating women as threat actors. And the last piece is just around general intelligence analytic training and advice. Great. That's what the company does.
And what's the new book?
It'll be on terrorist financing specifically. So I'm going to look at the difference between the organizational and operational financing. I'm going to present a bit of an updated framework for understanding what terrorist financing is. So most people think, sort of equate financing with fundraising, but financing actually encompasses quite a much broader range of activities. So
yeah,
it's
like we've discussed.
So it's fundraising, it's money movement, it's storing and managing the money and obscuring the funds, so like hiding it, so the financial tradecraft. So I'm going to really unpack all of that and then see where I get to.
That sounds really interesting.
We'll have to have you back on.
Yeah, we'll have to talk about the second installment of threat financing.
How to do it. I mean, we'll wait.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for becoming an alum of Intrepid.
It's a real pleasure. I'm a big fan of the podcast.